1 Samuel 25. We are marching through the book of 1 Samuel. So if you're visiting with us, I'm going to give you a quick recap so we can catch you all up to speed. And we're all on the same place. Book of 1 Samuel is about three major characters. Those three major characters are Samuel, Saul, and David. Right. It's really sad because you can take a look at verse 1 and you're going to find out that today is the day that Samuel dies. So this is a sad day for the life of the Israelites and probably especially for David. David is on the run. He has been called out as a fugitive. Saul wants him dead and he will stop at nothing. He is hunting him down and he wants to take him out so that he doesn't have to worry about it, because Saul already has it in his mind that if David stays alive long enough, eventually David's going to become king. He's already kind of resigned himself to that fact. So if he could take out David, then maybe Saul has a chance to establish him and his dynasty, his son Jonathan. Of course, the problem is Jonathan and David had become best of buds, and they're really friendly. David has actually married one of the king's daughters. King's daughter's name is Michal or Michal, they're married. And everyone loves David. There was a hit song about David, and it was the top 10. It was there for a while. Saul slayed his thousands, David slaying the tens of thousands. So David is really well known. He's liked by all of the soldiers. He's liked by all of the bodyguard. He's liked by all of the people. He's liked by everybody except for one specific person, and that's Saul. We find out here that there's another person that doesn't like David. That's a guy by the name of Nabal. And we're going to talk all about what Nabal is about. What's interesting about 1 Samuel 25 is Saul isn't mentioned in this whole chapter till the very end, which has led some people to believe that playing the part of Saul today will be the man known as Nabal. So that is a possibility, and it could be a foreshadowing of what's really going to happen to Saul later on. I don't know. I think it's just a really good story that helps us understand it helps us understand chapter 24 and chapter 26 really well. Chapter 24, David has an opportunity to take Saul out. Remember, Saul goes into the cave to cover his feet. And as he's using the restroom in there, David sneaks up, cuts off corner of the robe, and then yells out, "I could have killed you." Well, the same instance is going to happen, different circumstances, different things. But David is going to have the opportunity again to kill Saul and take him out of the picture, but he chooses not to. And what's interesting is in between those two stories is this story of David. And you can kind of see David, kind of more as a regular old Joe like you and me, as a regular person that does not like to be injured or insulted, who has built into his body, just like you and I, a propensity towards revenge. Because I don't know about you, I know you all are the same way. All I have to do is just think of the time that you are cut off, right? When you're driving, okay, maybe you guys weren't driving, but you guys are driving and you get cut off, and what do you want to do? You want to whip in front of him and cut him off and slam on the brakes and look back at him, this hasn't happened to me lately or anything. And you want to exact some revenge on him. When someone hurts you, there's this thing in you that you want to get back at him. And again, in between 24 and 26, David shows this amazing restraint. He says, "I'm not going to kill Saul. I'm going to leave that up into God's hands. God has to decide that." And here we see David almost making a terrible blunder. And if I were going to title this sermon and give it a title, I would title this sermon, "Yes, You Can Stop." Yes, you can stop. It is possible. And that's what we see here from David, the ability for him to do something that instructs us very well of how we should be living. 1 Samuel 25. "Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him at his home in Ramah." The book's named after him. He's been the major prophet through this whole thing, and he gets three quarters of a verse, and he's gone. That's it. Samuel is done. He is out of the picture. The nice part about Samuel is he will make a return appearance. Very cool. In three chapters, which it'll take us a while to get there, three chapters from now, it will answer the question, can you conjure someone back up from the dead? Oh, yeah, it'll cause some really good stuff. I'm excited for it, Lynn. Are you? I love that chapter. It's a great... If you want to peek at it, 1 Samuel 28, Samuel gets called back from the dead. Makes it very interesting. We'll find out about that. So he's dead, but we'll see him again in a couple verses. Now David moved down into the desert of Maon. A certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. Now, what's interesting about that is it lists his property. I got up here in the book of Job, chapter 1. It lists Job. Now, Job was the wealthiest dude at the time. So this kind of helps us understand how wealthy was this man named Nabal. Job owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camel, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among the people of Israel. When it says greatest man, it's essentially saying he was the most wealthy, most influential person of that time. So the most wealthy person at that time, we've got Nabal, who has about a third of the wealth of the wealthiest person around. So you kind of get the idea. I don't know who the wealthiest person around is now, but take a third of the wealthiest from the wealthiest person around, you're going to be a very, very rich person. So Nabal is no schluff. He has a lot of money, and he's probably very influential. And the fact that they mentioned Carmel is probably significant because Saul, if you remember, erected a monument to himself in the city of Carmel. So chances are Mr. Wealthy Nabal dude and Saul have a connection. I can't prove it. I could just infer that from that little bit. Verse 3, his name was Nabal. Anyone know? A little bit later on, it'll give us the translation in the text. Anyone remember what Nabal means? Here we go. I got Psalm 14, verse 1, where the exact same word shows up. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. There is no one who does good. And the word Nabal is right here. He is a fool. And not fool like in a silly person, like a clown. This is more of someone who is completely and utterly against God's wishes. The same word again shows up in Isaiah 32, which is interesting because this has a lot to do with the chapter today. For the fool speaks folly, his mind is busy with evil. He's not just a clown. And he's not just someone that makes mistakes. He is someone who on a daily basis is thinking to himself, what bad things can I do today? What evil can I do? Who can I hurt today? How can I push someone down so that I could get ahead today? That's Nabal. He practices ungodliness and he spreads error concerning the Lord. The hungry he leaves empty, and from the thirsty he withholds water. So he's also greedy. That's the idea behind Nabal. Nabal is a fool. Now, of course, we could probably assume that this was not his, you know, the parents did not name him that, though that would be kind of interesting. But that would be kind of, you know, child cruelty right there. So most people believe this, his name Nabal came from just his life. And people started calling him just a fool. And that's how he was. Now, he's married, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband, a Calebite, meaning he came from the line of Caleb, was surly and mean in his dealings. In other words, he was really super duper wicked. Now, Abigail is interesting because everyone wonders, how does a beautiful, intelligent woman end up marrying such a doofus? Sandra Bullock. There we go. I don't know if we could get a better example. Sandra Bullock, yes, exactly. It happens all the time, unfortunately. Of course, this is where all the commentators start thinking, oh, it must have been an arranged marriage. I don't know if it was an arranged marriage or not, but I do know that here is this beautiful, wise person married to this absolutely evil, wicked friend. Now, I started thinking, because this would be interesting, wouldn't it? Is what happens if she actually did, it wasn't an arranged marriage and she actually chose it? Because I know that happens too, right? Very intelligent, wise people choose for their spouses someone that they should never, ever, ever, ever choose. And maybe it was for the money. Maybe it was because he was very influential, powerful. Whatever the case may be, Abigail is married. Sorry, this is dumb things that pastors do because I wanted to find out how many beautiful people are in the Bible. Because you take the word and say, how many times is it used of other people in the Bible? And it actually is used quite often of women. And a couple times it's used for men. David is described as beautiful. I think Joseph is described as. There's a couple beautiful things. Here's all the beautiful women of the Bible. I could write a book on this. Wouldn't that be cool? The beautiful women of the Bible. Genesis chapter 12, when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she, Abram's wife, who was named Sarai, she was a very beautiful woman. In fact, that was a really bad story because Abram says, pretend you're my sister so that they won't kill me and take you as their wife. And lies, and yeah, that's a bad thing. Genesis 29, we have two sisters, Leah and Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, which is a euphemism for saying your eyes, when you looked at her, you're like, oh, it kind of hurts my eyes just looking at you. That's kind of the euphemism that's going on. So she herself wasn't like half blind. It was when you looked at her, you couldn't look at her very long. She was that ugly. That's kind of the idea. But Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Nice. Who else is beautiful in the Bible? Tamar. In the course of time, Amnon, I don't know, Jesus may come back before we get there. 2 Samuel 13. In the course of time, Amnon, son of David, so David's kid, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. It's a bad story. Don't read it yet, okay? But Tamar is beautiful. Go on. 1 Kings, did you remember this one? This was that interesting story. She's only brought up once. Her name is Abishag. David is getting really, really, really old. And they don't have heating blankets back in those days, so they found a beautiful girl. And yeah, so Abishag, she was a beautiful girl. What else? Esther chapter 2, Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and feature. She was beautiful. Also, Job 42, Job had some kids, some sons and daughters, and at the end of it, it says, nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters. And isn't there like an organization called that now? Isn't that right? Yeah, Job's daughters, that's what I thought. I remember hearing that at one time. So, and their father granted them inheritance amongst along with all other brothers. There's only one other time that the word beautiful is then used of something other than a man or a woman. It's actually used of cows. Now, I don't know what a beautiful cow looks like, but a guy by the name of Pharaoh had a dream about these cows, and Joseph had to come and interpret it, and the fat, ugly cows ate the sleek. I don't know. What is a beautiful cow? We need a new billboard. Have a beautiful cheese comes from beautiful cows. Something like that. I know. So there's some factoids for you. I don't know what that does for you, but Abigail's beautiful. Verse 4. I don't know. Tell me, when I first read this, I'm sorry, all I could think of was the mafia. That's all I could think of. Now, you tell me what you think when you read it. I finally did some research, and I think I come to a really good conclusion. So, while David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. So he sent 10 young men and said to them, go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them. And the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable toward my young men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them. So I don't know. That's what I first thought of was, hey, you know, we're out here in the desert, and you've got a whole lot of shepherds and sheep here, and you know what? Nothing bad ever happened to them. You know, nothing ever went missing. Nothing was ever stolen from them. It was almost like they were providing protection from them, though it really meant, I just won't attack you and kill you type thing. That's kind of what it sounds like. But when you take what happens a little bit later on in a servant and his description, and we also remember that back in those days, one of the most important things, one of the primary virtues of a Middle Eastern person that we do not have here in America or probably in any other country, the greatest virtue that you can have is hospitality. Literally, if a stranger came up to your door and said, I don't have a place to sleep tonight, you would be mandated by cultural norms to offer this stranger complete boarding, food, and protection. So even if this man, let's say he was running from the bad guys, and he came to your house and you offered him protection, literally, you had to then protect him from anyone that would even dare attack him. That's the idea of hospitality. If I were a traveler and I just stopped off in your town and I go and you're out there having a nice little picnic, I could come up to you and say, may I have some food? And the culture dictated that you would have to give me food. So we got to remember that in this cultural context, that the hospitality that David was asking for was normal hospitality. But beyond that, he also said that he did give some protection. And I heard this and I thought this was probably a good analogy to it. Let's imagine it's Thanksgiving and let's say you're really wealthy and you're going to throw this big party. Not just Thanksgiving dinner for you and your family. We're talking Thanksgiving dinner for the whole block. Everyone's invited to your house. You're going to have so much food prepared there. It's going to be sickening. And let's say that outside there was a catering truck was there and someone comes up and says, hey, I just want to let you know that a couple of guys tried to just rob your catering truck, but we chased them off. And, you know, we don't really mean to be a bother, but we don't have anywhere to celebrate Thanksgiving and we have absolutely no food. Do you think we could have a little bit of food? Even if with that analogy, then the cultural norm of our day would say, well, yeah, thank you so much for protecting this. Thanks for protecting that truck. You don't have anything? I've got so much stuff here. Of course you could have some food. So when you put it in that context, this makes, I think, a little bit more sense. That's all David is asking for. He's not asking for anything extravagant. He just needs some food. Verse 9. So that's the message you're supposed to give. When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name. Then they waited. Nabal answered David's servants, who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Which is kind of funny because it betrays the fact that they know exactly who David is. You don't know who David is? Goliath, big guy, everyone was there, saved us all, married the king's daughter, has been living there, captain of the king's bodyguard. Everyone knows David. What essentially is happening here is if, let's say, a very wealthy person decides to hire someone as a day laborer, and the day laborer comes and works and works and works, and at the end of it, this very wealthy, powerful, rich person says, you know what? I'm not going to pay you. And you know why? Because I can. I don't have to pay you. There's nothing you can do. You can't call the cops. You can't fight me. I am richer, smarter, more powerful than you. And I think that today I don't really wish to part with my money, so I am going to go ahead and hold on to it. That's what's going on here. Some people even do believe that David and Nabal actually entered into a working contract. But that's what he's saying. David? I don't know any David. And then he goes on and says, many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered from my shears and give it to men coming from who knows where? We're going to find out a little bit later. Abigail comes and rescues this whole thing and grabs some food that is never missed and grabs just gobs and gobs of food. It's not as if Nabal would have actually given some food. Everyone still would have, I don't know about you, but when I cook Thanksgiving dinner, I could usually afford to have 3, 4, 5, 6 dozen more people in my house because there's that much food. And that's what's happening here. What was that? Could I feed 600? I don't know if I could feed 600, but there was only 10 in the delegation. So essentially, all he was saying, can you provide something for us? Because he didn't even give a specified amount. You know, it's kind of like what I do when I do a wedding. Everyone says, well, how much do you charge? I don't have a charge. I feel guilty every time. I've only charged someone once for a wedding, and I had such bad guilt afterwards. I'll never, ever do it again. But that's essentially what David is saying. I have protected and done this for you. Now you just give me what's right. Just give me what's fair, and that will be fine for us. Do you have some food for my men? So, yeah, I think with the food that's provided, I think, yes, they could have easily fed 600 without a problem. I mean, this is a big party. It's festival time. Don't ask me which festival, it doesn't say. But it's party time. It'd be the equivalent of our Thanksgiving or Christmas. Where am I at? 12. David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word. David said, Well, that's okay, because Jesus said to turn the other cheek. So, oh, wait, no. David said to his men, put on your swords. So they put on their swords, and David put on his. How many swords did they have? About 400. Because 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supply. So David, you got 200 men that stay back, you get the inference that they don't have the extra 200 swords. But he's actually collecting men. I remember a couple chapters ago, he only had 400 guys. Now he's got 600. What do you think they're going to do with these swords? I think they're just going to wave them around and say, I'm going to hurt you, please give me money. No, they're. We find out later that David's goal at this point is he's going to kill everybody. No, I'm sorry, he's going to kill all the men. Women and children will be safe, but all the men are going to die. Does this sound like David to you? What happened to the David of, you know what? Even if I'm wronged by this idiot named Saul, even though I'm supposed to be in the palace and he's supposed to be gone, even though he's confessed it himself and I've had the opportunity to kill him, I'm going to let God take care of it. But at this point, you get the sense from David that there's the straw got laid on his back and it was the last straw. Yep. Samuel's now dead too. This is a bad day for David. Here he is. He's on the run, has no food. He's just trying to survive. He's told that he's going to have the kingdom, but the king won't let him have it. And now he just needs to get a little bit of food, provides this protection, protects the sheep, and does it out of the goodness of his heart. And he is told, you get nothing. And David snaps. I don't know about you, but I've done it a couple times. When you just can't take it anymore. I also think, again, I can't prove it, but I don't know. I hypothesize, I wonder if after that incident, last chapter with Saul, when he realized, wow, I have done such good for this person, and he has repaid me only with evil. You know what? I think I'm done with doing good to people. You ever get there? Where you, I've given and I've given and I've given and I've given and all you do is hurt and damage me. You know what? I'm done. I'm done with you. The next time someone shows any evil towards me, I will repay it full force, evil for evil. I can't prove that that happened to David or that went through David's mind, but I wonder if it did. Because you get this story, they come back and they said, Nabal told us to take a hike. Grab the swords, we're on. Let's go. That's how David's feeling right now. I think we've all been there. I think we've all made choices in our life that take us down a path. And I believe that God, in His goodness and His mercy, provide roadblocks or distractions or something along the way that will cause us to go, should I stop? Can I stop? I've chosen this path. Should I keep going? The same thing's going to happen here with David. Verse 14. One of the servants told Nabal's wife, Abigail, David sent messengers from the desert to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Do you get the idea that it was more than just, hey, I was providing protection for you. Can you spare something? There was something maybe prearranged, or this idea of hospitality, or Nabal probably didn't just say what he said there. There was probably a whole lot more that got said in there. He was hurling insults. So even one of the servants realized, this is not good. And we just did something very, very terrible. And I love it. Who did they go to? Abigail. Men, If people have to go to your wife to go to you, that's a problem. That's not good. I mean, praise God for Abigail's all over the place. Praise God that women, I don't know why it is. I'm trying to think of a reverse time of the sexes. Usually men don't protect the wives from the wives' mouths or things like that. It's usually the woman that steps in and knows how to talk to the husband, knows how to get him to think correctly. That's what's happening here. Abigail is, and all the servants, they go straight to him. They'll even say it a little bit later on. We can't go to Nabal. There's no way. He won't listen to us. So, verse 15, yet these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us, and the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. And check out this verse. Night and day, there were a wall around us all the time we were herding our sheep near them. And in essence, when you were a shepherd out there by yourself, you had to worry about wolves and bears and lions and tigers and all that stuff. Oh, my. And also, you had to worry about people, because you could just walk up, grab a sheep, and start running. What is the shepherd going to do? Go after you or stay with the other sheep? Oh, shoot, we've lost another sheep today. Oh, well, I guess that's life. But David and his men provided this wall of protection, saying, no bad guys are going to get through. Verse 17, now think it over and see what you can do. You can hear them saying this to the wife. Can you do anything? Because we're going to die. Because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him. Abigail lost no time. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep. I don't know what they were dressed in. 5 tuxedos, bow ties. 5 dressed sheep, that means they were ready to eat. 5 seahs of roasted grain, which would be about 37 liters. So take a 2-liter bottle and you got about 18 of those 2-liter bottles full of grain. 200 cakes of pressed fig. Oh, wait. Oh, the 100 cakes of raisins. That's cool. 200 cakes of pressed figs. Fig Newtons. How'd you like 200 cakes of, cakes of Fig Newtons? Nice. And loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, go on ahead, I'll follow you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. Think of all the food she just took, and Nabal doesn't even see that it's missing. Does that tell you how much food was available? I mean, there was so much food. She literally grabs there are 200 loaves already ready, and she takes 200 loaves, and then you look back at the loaves of bread, and there's still so many loaves, it doesn't even look like anything's gone. That tells you how much. That's why Nabal, in his greed, he couldn't even spare just a little bit of food for these guys. Abigail's able to grab this much food at a moment's notice, and she heads out. Verse 20. As she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending toward her, and she met them. David had just said, do you get this? Listen to the frustration in his voice. It's been useless. All my watching over this fellow's property in the desert so that nothing of his was missing. He has paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David. And there's a text note that it might be David's enemies, but I think it's David. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, he's calling down a curse, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him. So he's going to come and kill everyone. This is sheer frustration. We've all been there. Whether it be a spouse or a child or a parent or a coworker or a neighbor, when you get to the end of your rope and you're like, that's it, no more kindness. I have run out. The kindness tank is empty. I don't care what happens, I'm going to kill them all. Of course, this one made me wonder if Abigail knew that. I wonder if she would have just stopped. You're going to kill all the males, including Nabal? Is that possible? Please, you wonder, but no, this is the nice part about Abigail. She shows a depth of righteousness that is rather amazing, where she's not concerned about her own self. She's concerned about others. And the interesting thing is, I think the person she's concerned about most is David. Abigail, I'll just give you a hint now, Abigail turns into a type of Jesus Christ. Look at what she does. Verse 23, when Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed down before David with her face to the ground. Would you have done that? You are the wife of the wealthiest, most powerful man in the area, and you're going to get off your donkey and bow your face to the ground to someone else? She fell at his feet and said, my Lord, just so you know, the word Lord is used a lot here. It's the word Adonai. In our vernacular, we would say, sir. Sir. So, anytime you see this idea of Lord, that's what she's saying. Please, sir. Please, sir. Sir. It's a way of being deferent. Here we go. My Lord, let the blame be on me alone. Wait a second. Blame be on me alone. Did Abigail do anything wrong? So, you're telling me that Abigail was willing to take the punishment for an absolute, utterly wicked fool? makes you think. Because that is exactly what Jesus Christ did for us. Humbled himself with his face to the ground, with his back on a cross, and was willing to take all the punishment for the fool so that he'd be saved. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. Verse 25. May my Lord pay no attention to that wicked man, Nabal. And the word for wicked there, in the Hebrew, it's a strange phrase. It's the son of Belial. It's just supposed to be like the worst. Yeah, it's a bad phrase. I only pulled out one. There's a bunch of them, but it was used earlier in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Eli's son, remember them? They were wicked men. They slept with temple prostitutes. They took offerings that didn't belong to them. They robbed the poor. They didn't care. They acted in the place of God when really they weren't. That's the idea behind Nabal. That's how bad he is. It's not that just he was a bad guy. He was completely and utterly wicked and wrong in every possible way. He is, okay, I don't suggest this, women, okay, you know. He is just like his name. Fool is his name and folly is his game. But as for, I don't suggest women, if you are married to a fool, and I know that some of you are, don't, am I right though? No, all the guys here are awesome. It's just Heather's the only one married to a fool here. So we know who we are, Sean. We're man enough to stand up and take it, huh? Exactly. I wouldn't suggest women that it's not a good idea to go around. Abigail's not the most picture perfect. I mean, she's a human being herself, but I think she does, and almost everyone seems to agree. She goes a little far here in her description and essentially slams the husband, and she doesn't need to. And that's what I think happens. We get by ourselves or away from husbands or wives, and we're really quick to bring down judgment. So I fault Abigail for that, but, you know, she is human. And she is married to a fool. And at the end of it, she says, but as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master sent. So she was saying, look, I wasn't even there. Like, if I was there, I would have handled everything. But I'm sorry, I wasn't there. Now, since the Lord, Abigail is smart. Now, since the Lord has kept you, my master or sir, from bloodshed, and from avenging yourself with your own hands, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal. In other words, what she's saying, she's like, David, I'm so glad I got here so that you wouldn't do something stupid. I'm so glad I came because now you're not going to shed any blood. Now, no decisions have been made, but do you kind of hear? Women, you're good at that. You're good at planting things in our heads that, you know, drive, you guys are wily that way. But that's what she's doing. Wow, David, it's great that I caught you in time. And let this gift which your servant has brought to my master be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's offense. For the Lord will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my master because he fights the Lord's battles. Let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. I don't know, I love that phrase. She's saying, you know what, David, you're bound up. You're wrapped up. You're a bundle. You're wrapped up with God. And you got to think about this before you make a most terrible mistake. She's smart here again. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. Isn't that good? She's like, you know what? And all your enemies will be like that rock that you slung at Goliath and killed him. You know? She knows how to do these words here. When the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed, or having avenged himself. And when the Lord has brought my master success, remember your servant. She goes, David, you don't want to do this. So, how about all of us? We're heading down a course or a path. We've decided in our mind that we are going to do something. Maybe we're going to take revenge against someone. Maybe we're going to make a terrible and colossal mistake. Maybe we've just got it in our mind, choose your sin, gossip, anger, pride. And you're like, you know what? I don't care. This is what I'm going to do. And something happens. And I tell you, it always does. Something usually comes along your way, and it's almost as if God is throwing up this roadblock saying, you may want to rethink what you're about to do. Do we have the ability to say, you know what? I think I better stop. Because you can stop. That's why God does that for us. And I think sometimes, I'm going to talk to the guys because we're usually the most pride-filled people. Girls, if it applies to you, fantastic. But I know about you guys, no guy likes to admit he's wrong. No guy wants to say, man, I think I made a mistake. No guy likes to be the first person in the argument to say, you know what? I'm really sorry that I just did that to you. It's usually the woman that does it. It's amazing. Guys, we need to learn something about when something happens, we need to be able to say, we need to be able to man up and be strong enough like David, because, oh, I guess I just let the cat out of the bag. Guess what David's going to do? David's going to change his mind. He's going to go, oh my gosh, you are right. That was a terrible mistake. And us men need to be able to say, and I think that's also then for the women too, anytime we are about to do something really stupid, that are we able to say, you know what, I'm going to change my mind. I would love it personally if all politicians did this. I think the world might actually end. Wouldn't that be crazy? I have yet to hear a politician stand up and go, you know what? Man, I did a stupid thing. I am so sorry. I don't ever really hear that. You know what? I voted for this. I think I made a terrible mistake. Do you ever hear that? I usually hear spins and this or excuses or justifications. That's what I would like to get for all of us to remember, is that it's not up to us to justify or make excuses. It's up to us to say, you know what? I made a mistake. But we have no examples of that. And that's so sad. And that's why this example here in the Bible is amazing. Verse 32. David said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands." I was going to take matters into my own hands. I was going to do it. But you're right. Men, can we say that? I mean, how often do we actually say, yeah, honey, you are right? How many times do we say it to our kids when our kids are right? I know it doesn't happen that often, Chris. But when our kids are right and we've made a mistake, do we have the guts to go up and say, yeah, boy, I messed that one up? Kids, when you make a mistake, you able to go to your parents and say, man, I messed that one up. I'm sorry, Mom. I'm sorry, Dad. Verse 33, oh, I just did verse 33. 34, "Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." Then David accepted from her hand what she had brought him and said, "Go home in peace. I have heard your words and granted your request." And again, David's not the picture-perfect example playing the part of God, but that is exactly what happened on Easter when Jesus made the sacrifice and gave the offering. God said, it's good. I will not bring any harm to my people. Verse 36, when Abigail went to Nabal, it's so funny. Nabal, you get the idea, Nabal doesn't even know that she's gone. I mean, that's really sad. He's a drunk. He was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk. So he is totally and utterly plastered. I don't know, Abigail probably, you know, when you get an evil, wicked man getting drunk, don't they normally turn even more evil and wicked. Yeah. Abigail, I think she makes the right choice. She told him nothing until daybreak. Then in the morning when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. The word, his heart failed him, it actually says his heart died. That doesn't quite make any sense for us, but most commentators trying to bring it into our vernacular said that Nabal had a stroke and became paralyzed and was living, was still going on, and then 10 days later, died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Praise be to the Lord who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt." And check this out. He has kept his servant from doing wrong. And that's what God wishes for you, that you would refrain from doing wrong. And it's great that David got a chance to see that my actions, I could have. Have you ever wondered that? I sometimes do that. I try and go into alternate universes for my own mind, saying, you know what? When I did that really stupid thing as a kid, when I broke into Ben Franklin and stole candy bars, what would have happened to me? Yeah, Rich is like, what? You did that? I did. I was horrible. It was my friend's fault. It wasn't my fault. See, there's that excuse part. Yeah, I'm good at the excuses. Man up. I did it. I sinned. I broke in with my buddies. We stole candy bars. And I sometimes think to myself, what would have happened if the cops actually caught me? How different would my life be? Whoa. Think about that with other things you've done. I think about other times when, I don't know, I do this in the car a lot. Have you ever done something stupid in the car and you realize, I almost just died? How different my life would be? And that's what David... I'm such a genius, aren't I? I'm going to clip that particular part on the sermon. I'm going to post it on my website, and I'll say this is, you know, the theme for today. If you die in a car accident, it'll change your life. Yeah. Jeez. Make it into a ringtone. Y'all could do that. Wow. Yeah. I sometimes think about how things would be different if God hadn't protected me from a lot of different things. And I'm so thankful. David got a chance to see, wow, I almost made a huge, colossal mistake. Thank you, Lord. Well, since Nabal's dead, I guess that means Abigail's available. Then David sent word to Abigail asking her to become his wife. Wait, I thought he was married, wasn't he? He is, but we find out a little bit later that actually Saul took Michal and married her off to someone else, you know, to try and cut off things. So technically, he does only have one wife at this time, but actually, no, he has a second wife too. I'm trying to justify poor David here. But he says word to Abigail, and she bowed down with her face to the ground and said, "Here is your maidservant, ready to serve you and wash the feet of my master's servants." I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, talk about going from one lifestyle to the next. Going from, I have all the wealth, all the power, all the influence in the world. You got thousands of Fig Newtons at your disposal, and now you're going to go live with David. Who's by himself and out in a cave. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to go to the kids. So, but she could have stuck around and lived off of her kids. If she actually had kids. I mean, I don't know. Again, the tough part, like we see with Eli's wicked sons, if the sons are as wicked as the dad, it could be a bad scene for her. Yeah, it is possible she might have thought. But yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I'm sorry, women, I'm going to offend you right now, but this is how it was back then. Women, the wives were property. You were property. So if you were in need of protection, you were just a lone piece of property, providing that protection would be an act of grace. And that's, again, wives back in those days were not lifelong companions. They were baby producers and providers, mates. Yeah, that's all it was. Sorry. Sorry if that's rude to you women. Power to the women. I'm happy I only got one wife. Yay. Had two wives, I would die. And also there was no time, at this point, God hadn't given down a verdict about polygamy, and that's why David has a couple wives, and then his son Solomon, the idiot, wisest man in the world, but he had 1,000 wives. Yeah, you're real smart, dude. Yeah, no thanks. But that, again, most of those marriages were marriages of treaty. So again, because women were property. So that's what was happening there. So she says, okay. Verse 42, Abigail quickly got on a donkey and attended by her five maids, went with David's messengers and became his wife. I'm sorry, here's that passage. We looked at it briefly, but I don't know if you remember it. David had also married Ahinoam of Jezreel. Who's Ahinoam of Jezreel? Do you remember that one? Yeah, it was a while back. So we got to take a peek at it again. 1 Samuel chapter 14. Saul's wife's name was Ahinoam. It is possible, I do offer it up as a possibility, that there were two Ahinoams in that day, and they just happened to, you know, it'd be kind of weird hanging around the banquets if there's a couple of, like, Heather Mannings running around. That'd be really odd and awkward. So it is possible, but there is this really strange verse that I found a little bit later on when David does the whole little thing with Bathsheba, right, makes the big giant mistake, and then in comes a prophet by the name of Nathan saying, dude, what's wrong with you? You're an idiot. And this is what he says. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. Now, some people then say that, no, that would have been after David ascended to the throne. He took over the property known as Saul's harem and Saul's possessions. So that could be, but that does make one wonder. Tad Ahinoam run away and marry David? I don't know. And then it ends with this strange verse, but Saul had given his daughter Michal, David's wife, to Paltiel, son of Laish, who was from Galim. So Michal gets married off to someone else. So, can you stop? You know what? I also believe, like I said earlier, that if you are going down a path or choose, and you know what? I don't need to tell you what the sin is because it's your life and you already know it. If you're making mistakes, I can guarantee you that somewhere along the way, someone or something came into your life that showed and proved that what you were doing was wrong. And can you man up and say, I've made a mistake? Let's pray. Father God, thank you for your word and your power and your presence. Thank you that you... Thank you for Jesus Christ who came and took the blame for us fools and offered a sacrifice so that we might not be slaughtered. I pray, Lord, that you would continue to offer us grace those times when we are making some major mistakes. And I pray, Lord, that you would continue to show kindness by providing those Abigails, those people, or those events that make us pause and stop and go, oh, that was almost really bad. And I thank you that you're so merciful for us and that you don't repay the evil that we have with evil, but you repay all of our evil with good through so much love, through so much care, through the death of Jesus Christ. So as we go our way, Lord, I pray that you would encourage us, show us, convict us that yes, we can stop because of what you have done for us. In Jesus' name, amen.